Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, of course, is President's Day. We have three different interviews that we're going to be sharing with you, and the first two involve our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. I was delighted recently over the telephone to make acquaintance with a gentleman by the name of Eric Richardson, a friend of WGTD's own Jim McClure. Eric Richardson is what he likes to think of as a tribute artist. Some might call him an impersonator, but he prefers to be called a tribute artist, and he portrays people like Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird. He sings concerts as Dean Martin. He has portrayed Douglas MacArthur, and perhaps most notably, and in settings all across the country, he has portrayed our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. Here is a portion of the conversation which he and I recently had, talking about this facet of his fascinating career. I asked him how he began portraying Abraham Lincoln.
I started out doing, not to get off your subject here, I started out with the tribute and industry doing Dean Martin. And I was sitting in a... I was also doing some background work for some films, and there was a film being shot in Baltimore. I was at the table having lunch, and a lady said, "You look like somebody." And I said, "Yes, I look like Dean Martin. I do Dean Martin." She says, "No, well, yes, you do, but you look like somebody else." I said, "Who, pray tell?" And she said, "You look like a postage stamp." And at that time, there was a new Forever stamp that had come out honoring Gregory Peck, and the image they used was him as Atticus Finch. And she said, "You look just like Gregory Peck, Atticus Finch." So I said, "Well, why not? I do Dean. Why not try to do Greg Peck?" So I started looking at his roles. And obviously, he won the Academy Award for doing Atticus Finch. That's the one he's best known for. But Greg liked his hero was the 16th president, and he decided to, he just treasured the one time that he did President Lincoln. It was pretty much a cameo role, very small role. It wasn't, you know, that big, but it was in The Blue and the Gray, a TV miniseries. So that's one of the roles that I picked up, and since I live in Baltimore, which is a great proximity to both Gettysburg and Washington, D.C., I thought it was a pretty good fit. So I glued a mole onto my face, had a beard made, and went and got all the other things, the costuming together, and started studying Mr. Lincoln. And I've gotten a lot of work in Washington, D.C. recently.
Well, one of the intriguing things about this assignment that is portraying Lincoln versus, for instance, portraying somebody like Dean Martin, is that most of the world knows exactly what Dean Martin sounded like. That is no mystery. But, of course, when it comes to somebody like Abraham Lincoln, who has not walked the earth since 1865, we know very much what he looked like. He was among our most photographed presidents of that era, but we don't have a clear understanding of exactly what he sounded like, apart from maybe written descriptions from the day.
Correct.
Tell us what you have thought about in terms of giving voice to Abraham Lincoln.
Well, giving voice to Abraham Lincoln, I've listened to everybody saying that he had a high-pitched, squeaky voice. That is most of the things that I've heard about him, written descriptions that I have read and been told by other Lincoln impersonators, or they call them presenters. Lincoln presenters is better than impersonators. I didn't particularly care for the high squeaky voice, so I figured I would just do it as Gregory Peck, Gregory Peck's voice, and listen to the way that he did it. And I thought that would be fine to do. I came across an article. It was in a magazine called Liberty Magazine, and it was in the 30s, like 32. It probably came out about the time that the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated. And the article interviewed the last person who was actually at the Gettysburg Address, who was actually at the dedication ceremony in Gettysburg, and heard Abraham Lincoln. And his description of Abraham Lincoln was, he gave the speech in a low, melodious voice. I said, thank you. Now I've got somebody who I can at least, not do it in that high sing-songy voice that Abraham Lincoln supposedly did.
Hmm. You wonder sometimes that if one reason there was that people had that impression was because Abraham Lincoln, of course, towered over most people standing, wasn't it 6'4" or something like that? And perhaps people had the expectation of a mighty voice ushering from such a frame. And if, in fact, he had a voice that was maybe a bit more ordinary, people might, in a sense, sort of misinterpret it or misunderstand just what that voice sounded like or not remember it quite right.
Well, he was tall. He was tall, true, but he was not big. He was lanky, very scrawny, skinny guy, lanky guy. I weigh probably a lot more than he does, and I'm 2 inches shorter than he is. But, if you think of a guy who looks like a big bird standing there, you might think of the voice being that thin voice as well. So there are a lot of ways to look at it, sure.
So what are some of the more interesting places and situations where you have had the opportunity to portray President Lincoln?
Portray President Lincoln. I was hired to present Lincoln at one of the inaugural balls recently, of course. It was Saturday. It was the day after the actual inauguration. It was the Washingtonian inaugural ball, and it was held at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. And the cool thing about that was I got there early, of course. Had difficulty. It was that Women's March was going on that day. I came out of the parking garage. I was already dressed as Lincoln, and there were probably, a dozen motorcycle cops right outside the garage that came out. Of course, I stood there for the next 15 minutes taking pictures of these guys. They couldn't get enough. I'm walking towards the National Portrait Gallery, and women started coming up wanting their pictures taken with me. And finally got into the portrait gallery itself, which was still open to the public. So I went and had a few interesting pictures taken of myself in front of the portraits of Abraham Lincoln and walked around talking about some of the other presidents with people that were in there. That's just little things that I knew about the different presidents, because once you start one, you got to do a couple of others. I mean, I've got a great wicker wheelchair that I use for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I eventually want to do George Washington, but Abraham Lincoln is so cool because it's like everybody knows him. You're correct. They know what he looks like, and you immediately turn heads and you put that hat on, and then it adds to the height even more. That wonderful stovepipe hat that he would wear, which he used as a briefcase, by the way. I don't know if you know that. He kept all of his speeches in the hat. And since Abraham Lincoln, words were so important to him, and they were so important that he get them out correctly, and he does not want to be misinterpreted as to what he says, he would always read his speeches. He never spoke extemporaneously. Because he was afraid that he would say something wrong, it was could be construed in an improper manner.
When you
interesting man.
When you are portraying him, are you similarly, speaking from prepared remarks that are written out and excerpting very specific speeches? And if so, are these the speeches that are his most famous, like the Gettysburg Address or the second inaugural address, or are most of your appearances, in a sense, more spontaneous affairs?
Yes, I do a lot of spontaneous when I'm doing meet and greets, which is just standing around having pictures taken, and people will ask me questions. Of course, I don't have prepared remarks on that. If I do, if I am asked to speak as President Lincoln, I do write it down, and I do make a show of pulling it out of the hat, you know, and putting it in front of me on the lectern and speaking. But it's the Gettysburg Address that everybody wants to hear. I was amazed at the movie. I know you've probably seen the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis of Lincoln, and I was wondering how he was going to do the Gettysburg Address, and the way it was portrayed in the film was just, I thought, was the most awesome thing. He sat there and listened to two soldiers who had heard it, and they recited it back to him. And I thought, and the pouring down rain, it was just a wonderful, wonderful way to do it, because everybody loves those words.
I quite agree, with good reason.
I had heard that it is considered to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, speech ever made by a president. Hmm. And you do know that nobody applauded at the end of the speech when Lincoln gave it in Gettysburg at the dedication ceremony for the cemetery. You do know that. Nobody applauded. The guy that went on before him was a senator, I think, from the state of New York, who rambled on for like 2.5 hours in the heat of it was still pretty warm in November. They said it was kind of boring to listen to this guy. But Lincoln stands up and they introduce the President of the United States, and it's 2 minutes long, and he's done, and he turned around, and everybody thought that he was maybe stopping to get a drink of water to go on, so nobody applauded, no cheers, no nothing. And he was supposedly heard saying, "Well, I guess I was a wet blanket," because nobody, and you know, and then they realized he was finished. But there's so many interesting things about the life of Mr. Lincoln.
Tribute artist Eric Richardson. Someday we will share more of this interview with you, and as we talk about other aspects of his career. It's 8:23, and this is the morning show on WGTD. And on this President's Day, we have three different interviews that we're sharing with you. The next is from the archives, and it's among my very, very favorite morning show interviews of all time, with historian Philip B. Kuhnhart III, part of a long and extensive family tree of historians who in particular have focused their interests on Abraham Lincoln. Philip B. Kuhnhart's father was largely responsible for one of the most inspiring histories ever published, called 20 Days, which followed the events immediately after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. Philip B. Kuhnhart III is one of three co-authors of a book called Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Interestingly enough, this book begins with Lincoln's assassination in 1865 and takes us into the 1920s and to the dramatic day when the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated. It is, in a sense, a tracing of the history of how America came to understand our 16th president and his powerful legacy. At one point in our interview, I asked Philip B. Kuhnhart III to talk about the extensive photographic legacy of Abraham Lincoln, the presidents that came right before him, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan, those that came after him, Andrew Johnson, Ulysses S. Grant, were not photographed nearly so much as was Abraham Lincoln. I asked him why he thought this was so.
Well, as you say, Lincoln was not the first president to be photographed. In fact, I believe the very first president to be photographed in office was James K. Polk. There is a marvelous daguerreotype of him in the East Room, I believe, with his cabinet members, which is, you know, I believe marks the beginning of this era. Of course, photography was only invented in 1839, so So it was still very new. And for the first, 10, 20 years, these one-of-a-kind daguerreotypes and ambrotypes were all there were. And only after the invention of the negative could you have paper printing take place and mass reproduction of photography. And that was happening as Lincoln was rising into power. The idea that photographs could be distributed widely and people could own copies of them and that they could be published all across the land. Lincoln, I agree with you that Lincoln was the first president to be widely photographed and photographed on numerous occasions. I mean, we have only a handful of photographs of James Buchanan and his predecessors. And we only have a few images of the really old presidents like Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams were each photographed in old age, but well after their presidencies. Lincoln knew the power of photography to publicize his image. He knew the political power that it could have. And so he answered every opportunity to go to a photography studio to give his image to newspapers. And he realized that if people could know him and what he looked like, they would feel a sense of connection to him, and he could gain political support this way.
Hmm. I think that point is made in the documentary airing on PBS, which is also called Looking for Lincoln.
Yes.
The fact that, in a sense, this whole business of myth-building, if we want to call it that, to some extent was begun by Abraham Lincoln himself in this way, by the fact that photographic images of him he appreciated their importance and the enormous difference they could make.
I think he did, and it was funny though because he was widely considered to be homely, and so he liked to joke about how ugly his face was and how he would break the lens of the camera by sitting before it, and things of this sort. Most people who have studied his image don't necessarily agree with that assessment. I mean, he could. What strikes me is what a chameleon-like face he had. I mean, he could look extraordinarily different from one sitting to another, and this is in part due to his changing moods, which could be detected in the image, and in part because he wasn't a very typically clean, well-dressed man. His hair was often in disarray. His clothes were sometimes dirty. It was just, he didn't think that much about his looks. So he wasn't one of these people that sits in front of a mirror combing his hair for a half an hour before going on before a camera. Not just the opposite. And yet there was something real about his image that I think people could relate to.
Hmm. We're speaking today with Philip B. Kuhnhart III, and he is one of the writers responsible for Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. This is the companion book to a PBS documentary soon to air on the eve of what marks the 200th birthday of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. Mr. Kuhnhart, tell us a little bit about the fascinating idea which is behind this book, that is of creating a book about Abraham Lincoln, which in a sense begins with his death. What can you tell us about the genesis of that idea?
Well, some years ago, actually in the early 1990s, my father and I and my brother collaborated on a full biography of Abraham Lincoln in pictures and text.
Right, Lincoln, an illustrated biography.
Yes, and that was more traditional in the sense that it began with Lincoln's birth and ended with his death, though it had a very short section after the assassination on what we called the aftermath that I wrote, and that I remember once discussing with my father that it was a fascinating subject and that you could make a whole book on this, based on just the aftermath story. I remember that conversation some, 16, 17 years ago. So maybe that was in the back of my mind all these years. But when when my brother and I were discussing our plans for the bicentennial, and we knew we wanted to write another book for that occasion, and this is 5 years or 6 years ago, we were wrestling with what you could do. I mean, Lincoln has been portrayed so many times by so many different authors that it's very difficult to find a new way into the telling of his story. And one thing we did was, in preparation for the research, for the first time ever, we moved out of storage all of my great-grandfather's library. This had belonged to Frederick Hill Meserve and to his daughter, Dorothy Meserve Coonhart. And we set it up in our headquarters in Chappaqua. And it turned out to be a 5,000-book library.
Wow.
That had to do with the life and times of Lincoln. And it had been used sporadically since my great-grandfather's death, but really very sporadically. No one had ever made a consistent study of it. I spent a year reading in the library and getting to know its contents well. And I came to realize that a lot of the books had to do with the story of the aftermath, that they came from after the assassination, that they had to do with the great centennial year, 1909, that they had to do with the story of the memoirs of those who had known him, which were published at various times after the death of Lincoln. And suddenly I realized that it almost became clear to me that here is our new book. It's really the story of how the Lincoln we've come to know came to be after his life. And it just became clearer and clearer that that would be the focus of our new book.
Hmm. Well, and it's one of those things. It's a fascinating idea, so fertile, and it's also one of those books where you just are a little amazed that nobody ever thought of it before, and yet it is just enough beyond the obvious that it makes perfect sense that no one would have thought of it until now. I mean, that's one of the things that most intrigues me, I guess.
Well, I felt very lucky because the years of Lincoln's life, 1809 to 1865, are, as I say, so heavily traversed that there's little you can discover about those years that is new. I'm not saying nothing, because there are some marvelous new books that keep coming out that surprise you all the time. But the years 1865 to 1926, which is our date of coverage, are much less well-known, much less traversed. And so it was a rich area for research.
Hmm. I'm reminded of the PBS documentary series not too long ago about the era of Reconstruction.
Yes.
And the fact that I think for many people, and of course, that era is part of what your book covers,
yes,
of course,
yes,
but you know, similar sort of thing, that if you piled up the books about the Civil War itself and then beside them piled up the books which focused specifically on the Reconstruction era, I mean, it would be like David and Goliath.
Exactly. I mean, the books on the Civil War, it just are innumerable. The Lincoln Prize, which is offered each year for a great book on Lincoln, has specifically tends to avoid some of that Civil War literature.
One of the interesting things you do in your book, and one of the reasons it spans the particular time that it does, is that you help us follow much of the life of his son, Robert. The only son to live on many years beyond Abraham Lincoln. Tell us a bit about this intriguing figure and why, in a sense, it works so well for his lifespan to be, in a sense, kind of the framework here.
Well, you're absolutely right. That is why I chose the year 1926 to end the book. An original plan was to go through the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922, which was also a climactic moment in the consolidation of Lincoln's memory in our country. But Robert Lincoln attended that event, and he was an old man at the time, and he lived on just a few more years, and it seemed fitting to follow out his lifespan and end the book with his death and burial, which was so different than his father's burial decades earlier.
Hmm.
You know, whereas Lincoln's funeral was viewed by millions of people, literally, who waited in long lines to see him in his casket, and who stood by the train tracks as his train, as his body was taken back to Springfield from Washington. Robert had insisted on a private funeral, and only a couple of people were on hand for his burial in Vermont. Hmm. Later, he was transferred to Arlington National Cemetery, but it was just such a marked contrast to his father. And Robert is the only character who spans the entire book. He was there on the night of the assassination, where we begin the book. He had been invited to attend Ford's Theater with his parents. And he might well have gone, except he wasn't feeling that well, and he decided to stay home in the White House, where he was visiting, and sit up a little bit and talk with his friend John Hay, and then go to bed early. For the rest of his life, he berated himself for not having accepted that invitation. What might he have been able to do to prevent the murder if he had been there?
Right.
He asked himself. So he became a kind of haunted man. The loss of his father, to whom he had never been particularly close, who he always yearned for more closeness with. He became the kind of self-appointed guardian of his father's memory. And so in that sense, he played a very important role in the consolidation of Lincoln, the Lincoln legend.
And we find many examples of Robert Lincoln stepping in to denounce people who he believed were doing a disservice to his father's memory, or perhaps were conducting themselves in self-serving ways. And that's one of the stories here, unfortunately, is that we see more and more of that kind of activity.
Well, and he could go overboard. He could be controlling, and in a sense try to be too controlling of his father's memory. If for example, if a book came out that he disapproved of, he actually would, and he became wealthier and wealthier as he grew older, and he could afford to do this, and he would actually buy up as many copies of that book as he could find and destroy them, just to keep its influence from spreading.
Hmm. I think
he did this on numerous occasions.
I think one of the first times it occurred was actually a book which caused his mother, Mary Todd Lincoln, great pain, some sort of book or pamphlet that had been written by a woman that had been her seamstress and good friend.
Elizabeth Keckley, who was her seamstress in the White House, had been the dressmaker for other administrations prior to the Lincolns, and became a close confidant of Mary's. And really, at one point, she called her closest friend, which is interesting that a first lady would consider a black woman her closest friend.
A former slave, actually.
That's correct. But Lizzie Keckley, for one reason or another, later chose to publish a book in which she told many stories of behind-the-scenes stories that didn't put Mary always in the best light. They showed her tendency to emotional outbursts, her terrible despair after the death of her son, Willie, the fact that her husband at one point was considering having her sent to a mental hospital, things of this sort that just infuriated Mary Lincoln when they came out and led to the complete rupture between the former friends. But Robert, who was still kind of taking care of his mother, stepped in and tried to suppress this book. That was the first of many such attempts he would make.
Something else you tell us about Robert Lincoln that's interesting is how seldom he spoke publicly about his father. One interesting moment in the book is one of the only occasions when he gave a speech in public about his father. I mean, otherwise, he remained, in a sense, remarkably silent about him, which, of course, is intriguing and in some respects, of course, represents something of a loss to the rest of us.
Well, I do think it would have been good if Robert could have forced himself to write more about his father. Robert, as I said, in some ways didn't feel like he had known his father that well. His father was very busy as a traveling lawyer during his growing up years. Robert himself went off to a boarding school and then college in the East Coast, and he wasn't really around a lot. And furthermore, Robert always had a kind of aloofness about him that his parents both noticed. He just couldn't quite relate to him the way they could to their younger boys. And so I'm not sure, you know, what Robert's story would have been like. On the other hand, he didn't want to call attention to himself. He had a very private side to him, and he felt that he wanted the light to shine on his father and his father's memory and not on himself.
Hmm. Philip B. Kuhnhart III, the co-author of a remarkable book called Looking for Lincoln, The Making of an American Icon. Well, today is President's Day, and we think of all of our U.S. presidents, and we think also in particular of our first president, George Washington, whose birthday will be Wednesday, the 22nd of February. I want to play for you a portion of a conversation from a few years ago with a prolific author by the name of Thomas Fleming, and a book of his called Washington's Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge. Valley Forge, of course, is a name that most of us recognize, but most of us really do not understand much at all in terms of the specifics of what occurred there, and in particular of the brutally traumatic experience it was for George Washington, who had to show such great valor and determination in the face of such suffering and deprivation. Here is a portion of our conversation about this book again called Washington's Secret War, published by Smithsonian. I asked Thomas Fleming to explain what sorts of resources he could turn to in researching something like the Revolutionary War.
There are there's an amazing amount of material that's been put together by scholarly presses that is in the big university libraries. A lot of people kept diaries. A lot of people wrote letters which they saved. Letters of the delegates of the Continental Congress, for instance, fill over 7 volumes. You can find out what they were thinking about Washington, among other things. There's no dearth of material. This book could have been twice as long. I'm sort of launching a crusade against a tendency to write books that are too long these days.
Right. Let me ask you, too, when one is talking about this kind of firsthand information, I mean diaries or a letter which someone has written, I mean, whichever side you happen to be on, how does one figure out where the truth is in something about that? I mean, how do we know, for instance, that a given soldier isn't making honest mistakes or maybe even going out of their way to mischaracterize the events which they're observing in sort of the heated passion of the moment? Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, this is just like today. I think that one of the things that anybody who reads this book will say when they finish it is, things haven't changed very much. They're calling Washington the same kind of rotten names in this book that they're calling the president right now, or that they called the president Bill Clinton before him. We have always been a very outspoken people, and we tend to, I think, to it's human nature, though, to some extent, to be, when you're involved in great events, very meaningful events like the Revolution, where so much is at stake, emotions really run wild.
Hmm. Well, and of course, this book emerges at a moment in time when things are not going well for the Americans.
That is really the understatement of them all, Greg. But the Valley Forge, which today is a place that millions of tourists go to feel in touch with the heritage of heroism and endurance that the place has been enshrined as meaning, you know. But in late 1777 and early 78, when the whole ordeal was just beginning, it looked like a black hole into which the revolution was going to disappear.
Right. Tell us, first of all, about the city of Philadelphia and what had occurred not long before
Valley Forge, the falling of Philadelphia, if you will.
Right. Philadelphia was the loss of Philadelphia was the source of most of Washington's woes at Valley Forge. The British had invaded Pennsylvania in late August of 1777, and Washington had marched his army to fight them. And everyone understood that the prize was Philadelphia. He lost two battles in the course of this struggle. Actually, three, although he wasn't the commander of the third battle, which we call the Paoli Massacre, in which part of Washington's army was ambushed by the British and practically, just almost wiped out. But at any rate, Philadelphia was the third biggest city in the British Empire. It was in it was almost 40,000 people, which made it the biggest city in America. And it was a very wealthy city. It drew on all of this rich farmland all around it. So that each year, Philadelphia was exporting tens of thousands of tons of wheat and corn and iron to Europe. This was really we tend to think one of the big mistakes about the American Revolution is, as I've said in more than one book, is that the image of the primitive frontier clings to the Revolution. But America had been going for 150 years at this point, and there was a very sophisticated society that had developed. We were producing one-seventh of all the iron in the world at this point.
So
Philadelphia, it all came through Philadelphia, and they were very well-to-do set of people. And when the British captured this city, it was a terrific blow to the American morale, and a great many people turned on Washington as the man who was responsible for it.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting when you say turned on Washington, we have to probably hasten to add that they're not turning on Washington, D.C. There's no such place yet.
That's
they're
right,
turning
yeah.
on the man.
They turned on General Washington.
On General Washington.
The first chapter of the book, Greg, which you'll recall, I think sums up what was going on. My title is George Washington, Loser.
Right. And the fact that that these defeats which had been suffered by the Americans, there was this that really dissipated what had been kind of the air of invincibility about George Washington. He had been such a revered military hero from earlier conflicts.
His reputation had soared at the end of 1776 when he scored these two dramatic victories at Trenton and Princeton, which actually rescued the situation after he had suffered a whole series of defeats before that. He lost the battle for New York and had a retreat across New Jersey, but he did come back with these marvelous triumphs, and the press and everybody else rushed to sing his praises, and he was at a very high level. But here's what happened. Another thing, Greg, it's politics and life. Another general emerged who looked better than Washington. While Washington was losing two battles and losing Philadelphia, General Horatio Gates was fighting a British army in northern New York, just north of Albany, and he won. He beat the General Burgoyne, the commander of that army, and captured this whole British army. And pretty soon, there were all kinds of people in the Continental Congress and in newspapers and so forth who were thinking that General Gates was the guy they needed, not George Washington.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the Continental Congress, because this is really a fascinating story as well about, among other things, how the whole character of the Continental Congress had changed so drastically, and in one respect especially. You say of the political leaders of 1776 who voted for independence, only six remained in the present Congress. I mean, at the time that we're talking about now with
exactly.
Valley Forge. You say most of the delegates had never met George Washington. To them, he was only a name. Washington was equally unacquainted with the new men in power, and there was little in their conduct that inspired respect.
All of that is absolutely true, and it was this really that you put your finger on the heart of Washington's problem at Valley Forge. He really couldn't get these people to listen to him for quite a while, and their hostility to him could be summed up very simple, you know, very graphically, I guess you'd say, they decided, Washington requested that they send a committee to the Army so he could talk things over and discuss the real problems that were threatening the survival of the Army and the country. And James Lovell, who was one of the right-hand men of Samuel Adams, who was the leader of Congress, Adams was in Boston for a brief vacation, and Lovell wrote about this delegation that was going to see Washington. He assured Adams that they would be going to camp to wrap a demigod over the knuckles.
Hmm.
The contempt with which Lovell regarded Washington, and which was echoed by he was echoing Sam Adams's attitude. These people had a lot of the Congress anyway had a very hostile attitude towards a regular army. They were spooked by the story of Oliver Cromwell and how he became a dictator in the previous century, you know, and they kept seeing the possibility that Washington's regular army would turn into a Cromwellian dictatorship. And so they always were on there, were bugging the army and really not being very helpful. They were trying to force the army to put up with their ideas of how the war should be run and how the army should be supplied, which were all terrible ideas. It was they didn't really know what the devil they were doing.
Hmm. Let's talk about the supplies, the meager supplies with which the American Army was living at this point, and especially through the misery of Valley Forge. I mean, the stories are staggering of the number of soldiers who did not have something as basic as shoes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Their uniforms had worn out, and their shoes shoes were not very well made in those days. But you needed constant replacements, and the Congress just hadn't gotten around to producing any. I have this story of an officer on Washington's staff who said that he had three wealthy businessmen who were ready to set up a factory and produce 150,000 shoes in a year that would keep Washington's men in shoes for the next couple of years. Congress wouldn't even listen to him.
Hmm.
Why? Because that was bad to make money from the war. Sam Adams and the people around him in Congress were convinced that patriotism should be completely disinterested. Anyone who profited from the war was bad, evil, and so forth. And Washington had to fight this attitude, this idea, too, which he did. He really there's some startling stuff in the book about Washington's statements Washington made about patriotism, and which can be summed up very quickly by saying he said, patriotism is not enough all by itself to win a war. You have to appeal. Patriotism is important, but you also have to give men a stake. They have to be permitted to achieve certain things they need in order to keep survive and to help the country survive.
I mean, it's an interesting flip, because what we end up seeing is George Washington, in effect, a paragon of patriotism. I mean, this person we see in mythical dimensions,
yes,
actually being at this moment in time a very practical person, speaking very practically to the people in the Congress. And they,
exactly,
were the ones spouting platitudes about patriotism, thinking that's what was going to sustain them through this difficult effort.
Right. It was a false it was a false idea of patriotism. They were printing money with no, and they weren't taxing anybody, so that meant that the money started to depreciate. And yet they insisted that farmers should sell their cattle and food and wheat, rather, to the army for prices that Congress set the previous year, and they ignored the fact that the money was depreciating. And the farmers, instead of selling, hid their cattle in the woods and their wheat in the barns, and that was the chief reason why the army was starving.
Hmm. You also talk about how when fervent, desperate calls were made upon the Congress to get more resources to the army, more often than not, again, this is the more things change, the more they stay the same,
almost always they would confront difficult questions by forming a committee. You said into the hundreds, eventually into the thousands of committees that were formed to study and talk about these things instead of taking action, which is what was most needed.
Exactly. They refused to set up executive departments. This was the primitive form of government that we created in the revolution, and only by really painful lessons did we realize that Congress all by itself can't really do it all.
Hmm.
They eventually slowly learned to set up departments and so forth, and then finally in the Constitutional Convention, which now we're getting way ahead, but 20 years later they realized that there had to be an executive department of the government in order to execute the laws and policies that Congress set up. But these lessons had not yet been learned, but people like Washington. The amazing thing is the people like Washington were learning them and making Congress listen to them.
Absolutely. The other part of this story, of course, which is so interesting, you've already mentioned it, is the contention between General Washington and General Gates.
Yeah.
This general who was thought by some to be the person who should really take things over.
Right.
And you say that through the course of this story, we begin to see this side of George Washington who really, he understands how to go after not only his enemies in red uniforms, the British,
yeah.
but
right.
also he knows how to go after enemies from within his own ranks, so to speak.
He proves the whole idea of this book, or the most important idea, I think. Anyway, there are others. Ideas in it, of course, is Washington's emergence as a really good politician. He knew how to form alliances with some of the people in the Continental Congress. He knew how to take the offensive. That's a great idea, an important idea from military thinking, that you seize the initiative. Well, he did the same thing in politics. He wrote tough letters to people saying, I understand that you just said to General Gates that I am an idiot, words to that effect, is that true? And General Conway, the guy who wrote this letter, was, he was completely flabbergasted that Washington was fighting back. All of these critics of Washington were heaping these attacks on him. They assumed that eventually Washington, they completely misjudged him. They assumed that this very dignified, rather reserved man would just quietly decide that nobody liked him, and he'd resign his commission and go back to Mount Vernon.
Hmm. And
boy,
no such thing.
Were they wrong?
Yeah, Washington wasn't going anywhere.
No, of course,
eventually things begin to sort of fall apart for General Gates. Things go wrong in all kinds of different ways. Eventually those who had heaped all kinds of criticism upon Washington and all kinds of praise on Gates sort of had to eat crow and sort of slink back to the side of George Washington, who in many different ways managed to reassert himself.
Exactly.
As,
the great thing about it, Greg, is that he did it so well. He defeated these guys. And the next thing you know, as I say in the book, all these congressmen were making speeches and writing letters to their constituents saying, I never had a negative word to say about that great man, George Washington. In fact, they were saying all kinds of terrible things, but they just denied it. But then he just let it go. He did not hold a grudge against these guys who had tried to destroy him. Instead, he re-enlisted most of them, you might say, in the struggle for independence.
Hmm. Author Thomas Fleming and his book titled Washington Secret War, The Hidden History of Valley Forge, a Smithsonian book. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, among other things, you'll hear my conversation with flamenco guitarist and composer David Molendano, who is the guest artist this weekend with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Later in the week, Wednesday, you'll be hearing my conversation with Jonathan Starr, the author of a fascinating memoir about his experience in creating and funding and running a school organization